I don't think we're doing ourselves any favors. That's the honest truth. Something's changed in the world where it's like, you have to be perfect. You have to be like this sort of gifted human who shows up 100%, who looks perfect, who never makes a mistake. Firstly, that's unattainable.
This is a Baby Brunch podcast. This podcast is supported by Epimax Baby and Junior. The range of Epimax Baby and Junior Gentle All-Purpose Emollient Moisturizers is an all-day, everyday favorite for babies and children. Give your child a good start to every day by nourishing and protecting their skin with Epimax. Andy Cohen is a psychotherapist, a psychoanalyst, and she happens to be a best friend of my podcasts. The last time I had to deal with Andy Cohen, she was one of our guests on Mind at Work, a podcast that we created in the month of October where we wanted people in the workplace to feel supported mentally, whether it be mental health or mental illnesses. And at the time, we had a conversation around whether we are standing in the way of our work. I thought it would be fitting to bring Andy Cohen back because this time we're talking about whether we are standing in the way of our parenting. Her journey to be a psychoanalyst has been unique. And you know how the saying goes that whatever is your curse will become your blessing. Well, whatever stood in her way at the time led her to helping people as a psychoanalyst. Andy, it's good to have you back.
Thanks so much for having me.
The last time we chatted, you helped so many people in the workplace. We didn't understand at the time what psychoanalysts do. And for those who are listening to this conversation for the first time, what do you do and what makes it so much different to a psychologist or even a psychiatrist?
Yeah. So psychology sort of as an umbrella is just, I guess, the study of the mind, right? It's the study of thought and thinking and feelings, you know, so it all kind of falls under that umbrella. But psychoanalysis specifically thinks about the unconscious mind. So if you kind of think about an iceberg, you know how there's that little tip that's on the top of the water, that's your conscious mind. But below the surface is that where the bulk of it is sitting, that is your unconscious mind. And that is the part of your mind that you don't have any access to. It's sort of automated and running automatically. And it's got a huge influence on how we think, what we think, and why, and it governs all our conscious processes. So when people come see me, it's because they're suffering from feelings of some kind and they don't know why. They might notice that they're in patterns that they can't get out of. No amount of rational thought has gotten them out of the problem, or it's only helped like a little bit, and then they find themselves in the same situation. So then our work would be to try and understand what's underneath that hasn't been understood before, to try bring that up to the top of the surface so that it's kind of not running your life anymore.
So let's take a feeling for the sake of this exercise. I'm coming to see you as my psychoanalyst because I have, let's call it anxiety. In my parenting journey, I have this unnatural fear. There is worrying all the time, no matter whether the kids are safe or not safe. I'm worried about my schedule, whether I'm at work or not. There's an anxiety around my marriage and relationship and communication. The feeling is anxiety. How are you able to help someone with anxiety as a parent in your space?
Yeah, so anxiety is an interesting one because I feel like everybody talks about anxiety as if it's the name of a feeling, like love, hate, anger, sadness. Anxiety. I think of it a little bit different to that. I imagine anxiety as being kind of a state that you're in where your mind can't focus on the thing that you're feeling. And so it's kind of hopping from thing to thing to thing. And so the work there would be to try and think about what the sort of ecosystem that you're talking about, What are the patterns and the trends within that ecosystem? You know, what specifically makes you anxious? Is it a deadline? Is it the safety thing? Is it, you know, because actually there'll be, it feels like your life's chaotic when you're anxious and that, you know, anything can happen at any moment. But if you start to listen to the stories and the things specifically that make you anxious, there's actually like there are links to be made. There's a kind of a structure underneath all of that. And then my work is to try and understand what the trends are and what the storyline is underneath unconsciously to try and work out, to give some of that anxiety a name and a context. And when you start to really name it and work through what that is, then the kind of dust starts to settle and you're not in this like manic jumping around state, which can be so flipping and like unpleasant, yeah. You know? Yeah. It can be like torture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Torture and unpleasant is the right description for that really uncomfortable, like you call it, state.
Yeah.
Why are we standing in the way of being these amazing parents? You know, we live in a time where everything has to be remedied, you know?
Yeah.
We have to fix everything. Like, yeah. You know, you send sweets to school, we have to remedy your diet. We don't pray enough, we need to remedy your parenting skills, you know? But we can just never be enough as parents. Everything has to be fixed.
Mm.
Why?
We're very hard on ourselves, eh? As a bunch. It's, you know, I think what's so difficult is that we try and parent, you know, in like an isolated bubble, but actually there's like a whole world that we're living in. And if you think about like the world that we're in right now, like it's tough out there, man. Like if you just look at it sort of on a macro level, like between, firstly, COVID just stuffed everything up. Mm. And I think that really kicked the dust up. But politically, economically, like the world is in a real state.
The world is crying.
It really is. Like I think there's like suffering going on a macro level. And then I think just on a daily basis, like just even in our local context, like life is hard. Like it's hard to put food on the table. It's hard to show up for your kids, to show up at work. Like there's demands being made on you all the time. So then there's that sort of inner layer like of that. If you know, I'm sort of thinking of like
an onion. I can see you.
Yeah, yeah.
I can see you, Diary. She's literally peeling the layers off.
Yeah. Okay. I was you saying onion, I was thinking of like inside a tree, you know, like if you look at the trunk. And
yeah.
Like, so I was also thinking rings. Yeah, yeah. We're on the same wavelength. So if you're kind of going in the rings now, so then you're getting into your little inner circle now with your kids. Now your kids have a whole set of needs. They're going to need to be, besides the fed, clothed, all of that stuff, they're also going to have to like.
The school schedule.
Oh my God, don't even
feelings.
Get me. Yeah. Like then their feelings and then
the next birthday party.
And then there's an issue like with their friend and then there's a playground stuff and then there's whatever. And then another layer, now you've got your own needs and your own stuff and your own feelings. And then there's also all the stuff you went through as a child that's going to inform it. So actually,
wait a minute.
We're in trouble.
You just said something really important.
Mm.
And then there's all the stuff that has happened to you as a child also.
Yes.
Is that stuff that we need to work through in order to be better parents?
I mean, the short answer is I think yes, because I think we are in, you don't just come to your parenting experience now as like a blank slate. You're not like born the day that your children are born. Like there's a whole life that you've lived. You were a child, you were a baby, and all of those experiences live in you, like all those layers, they're in you. So how could they not be present when you're parenting? And the thing is, if you, you know, ignore it at your peril, that's my thought, because that stuff is governing you. It's a blueprint inside you that's going to kind of color the way that you think and feel and react. Now, in some ways, it's not necessarily a problem, but when there's conflict and when there's anxiety, it's because something about that is probably now layered on top, and then there's like a glitch in the system. And so it can be a problem. It's not always a problem, but I mean, I feel like everyone's got something to learn about themselves. I've yet to meet someone who's cured of themselves, you know?
I think we're very afraid to learn about ourselves because self-work is hard.
Very.
It's very, very hard.
Yeah.
I want to stay with this notion of, you know, that this is, we don't start on this clean slate when we become parents, that there's a life that was lived.
Yeah.
What if that life that was lived, because no matter how perfect our parents thought or how much and how the best they have done for us, something always happened.
Yeah.
Be it you got a hiding and you thought it was unfair, or the typical, which I hear a lot in our parenting circles, I will never have my children go through what I went through.
Yeah.
or be it a financial situation. In my case, it was food, you know. Even though we had enough food as a child, I didn't enjoy food. And so a lot of the time, I was really skinny and maybe at times dehydrated. And now in my parenting journey, I can see food is a really big issue. I went to go and see a dietitian the other day. And the more she spoke, the more guilty I felt. And the more I thought, this is actually not a diet issue. This is a psychoanalytical, I have lived a life before being a parent issue, because I will cure you with food, you know. You come into my house and if you haven't had a good day, I will make you pancakes. And if it starts raining like it did yesterday, I will make you soup because you deserve something warm and cuddly. And before you go to bed, we will do the bubble prayer and we will calm the house down. And then I will give you a hot chocolate because it's a treat.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I know that food in my childhood played a very big and massive role. Until today, food to me is joy.
Yeah.
Food to me is happiness.
And it soothes.
But it also means cholesterol. And it also means that I have something to work through for myself.
The thing is with food, food has got something to do with, so the way we think about food and eating in psychoanalysis is it's a taking in, it's an ingesting. And if you think about the first kind of ingesting that happens between a mother and a baby, it's, you know, breastfeeding or bottle feeding, it's that milk. There is such an important psychological laying down that happens with that, because you're taking in that goodness, you're taking it in. So that's like sort of on the one level, that practical nourishment. But there's another thing that happens that's metaphorically the same thing, which is a taking in of the baby. The mother has to take in the baby. She has to drink the baby and drink the baby's thoughts and feelings. And that is happening on an unconscious level for sure. And I think, you know, it fascinates me because nobody talks about this to new mothers, that they're doing something psychologically. You know how moms get that, what do you call it, preggy, mommy brain, you know, like when you, like you've just had a baby and like you're foggy, you're and you're forgetful, okay, and they're like, oh, it's the hormones and you're tired, and it is obviously all those things, but it's also because unconsciously you are like an auxiliary mind for that baby, because the baby's still forming its mind. Do you know how exhausting it is to be someone else's mind? It's exhausting. You're taking in every feeling that has never been felt before, feeling it for the baby, chewing it up, metabolizing it, giving it back to the baby so that they can manage it. So that taking in is happening from the minute we come into this world. And whatever your early experiences of your mother having done that with you is going to be laid down, and it can also mirror itself in your eating later, whatever that relationship was of the taking in or the not taking in. So it's a really complex thing. I mean, so eating and dieting and all those things are, they're very layered, you know, and they matter. It really matters.
Let's stay with that connection with mom and baby, because it's something that interests me. Baby has just arrived and everyone talks about foggy brain and, you know, baby brain, whatever they want to call it. Don't listen to them. Are we thinking and experiencing on baby's behalf? And what if those thoughts aren't positive? What happens to the relationship with mom and baby? And what is happening to me as the mother?
Yeah. So I think it's a really important thought, because how can they be positive? You know, how can they all be positive? Like, I think there's the fantasy that it's going to be just this beautiful, blissful, you know, but actually babies are, you know, you hear a baby cry, that is rage, man. That a hungry baby, it cuts into you, right? It's like it's an absolute communication of rage or panic or fear. These are not easy things to feel, actually. And somewhere as a mom, you need to be able to like not be too disturbed by that. So a lot of the time, like in postnatal depression, those communications are too disturbing for the mom. because something's gone wrong for her once.
Mm.
In fact, actually, I think the name, the word postnatal depression is problematic because I don't think it's a post. I think it's a pre. It's like something archaic in you that wakes up when the baby wakes up. And if your baby's cries, for whatever reasons, if those communications are too disturbing, then as a mom, you can't help but reject them and not think about them. And it's very painful for the mom and it's very painful for the baby. And so, you know, the work there would be to try and rethink these things that are evoked in you, those sort of very infantile things inside yourself. It's like you've got to find a place to think about those things, to metabolize them so that when your baby cries, they don't disturb you. Feeling those feelings is not a problem. It's a problem if it's disturbing and you reject them. Then it's not that you're doing anything wrong, but both of you need help.
So feeling those feelings is not the problem, because we often criticize the feeling. Why am I why am I feeling panicky? Why is my baby crying because of me? Why am I? So feeling the feelings is not the issue.
Not at all. It's whether or not you're disturbed by them. They're just normal feelings. You're allowed to feel panic. You're allowed to feel rage. They're actually very important. They're vital feelings. So the trouble is that if the feeling is too scary or overwhelming, that's the problem. So, yeah. So I think that's often where moms, particularly moms, obviously dads as well, would need help. You know, just kind of getting to know those feelings in themselves a little bit better, so that they're not overwhelmed when their baby feels it. And then, because, you know, like you hear those really extreme examples of like a mom just feeling so awful and so terrible and wanting, you know, having a vision of like wanting to chuck the baby across the room. You know, you hear that. And then people are like, oh my goodness, everyone starts panicking. What a lot of people don't realize is that that is an unconscious communication from the baby. It is not, and it's not, the baby didn't think that. The baby's feeling has been projected into the mother unconsciously. The mother is experiencing it as something very intense. She's actually doing her job, because she can feel something very deeply from the baby. But because something's happened and nobody's ever helped her think about that, she thinks she's doing something wrong because of the form that it's arrived in her mind at. And then she will eject the thought. That throwing away is not throwing away the baby, it's throwing the thought away, because she's received something that's given her a fright. So a lot of the work with moms and their babies is, you know, from like a psychoanalyst will work with them to try and help them get to know those feelings better so that they don't have to be frightened of them. And then everybody, you know, things just simmer down, actually.
We've now seen our psychoanalyst, or we haven't, and we've worked on this relationship with mom and baby. It's this constant communication of the traumas that has happened for mom. They've been suppressed all her life. She has a baby. Her life is perfect. And when the baby comes, we are feeling really angry and outraged, and we reject baby. Or time has moved on and baby is a toddler. We've survived baby stage. Toddler is going through his learning stages, or her learning stages, and we are truly unhappy parents, because this child, you know, I don't know why he screams so much. You know, this child never eats because he's naughty. You know, this child, we love you, but can you see what he's doing? Are we standing in the way of our parenting? What is happening to mom and dad, and in that case, to toddler?
Yeah.
Are there still pre things that are being suppressed? Is that why we are showing up that way?
Yeah. Geez, firstly, it sounds horrible. That sounds really unpleasant. It sounds like in that scenario that you're offering that people aren't hearing each other. I don't believe in like terrible twos. I think the feelings that get evoked are terrible because that's a time when the baby's starting to become independent. You know, it's like the walking and the running around.
I want to do it myself.
Yeah. And that is a very, very difficult thing for parents and for babies. well, toddlers, because they're starting to change and not need each other in the same way. And that is going to evoke, just in an ordinary way, it's like going to evoke so much. Like everybody wants their kid to get up and learn how to walk, but few would admit that it's actually hard not to be needed in that way anymore. And then depending on what your relationship is with being needed, is going to evoke your particular lens again. So, I mean, I think that at every stage that you reach in your life, and every stage that your baby into toddler, into teens is another one. You know, we'll get there when you do the teen podcast. every stage wakes up something in the parent.
Mm-hmm.
It evokes something. And it's not necessarily a problem to be solved, but it's a way into understanding what your child is struggling with. So I really want to make that clear, because I think it's not like we damaged and broken. It's like there's this amazing thing about humans that we have these blueprints inside us. We've gone through it. So if you can feel something deeply from your child, even if it's irritation, that is a communication. That is an opportunity for you to understand something firstly about yourself, and then it will lead you into whatever your child is dealing with. So it's like it's a reciprocity empathy tool. Do you know what I mean? Which I think is like a real gift, actually.
But how do we access this gift? I mean, so we all know that, I don't know, some of us grew up poor, or we didn't have, or we were without, or we had a father that was just a real terrible person, or there were hidings, there were bullies at school. And there's also the narrative of, I'm not going to do it the way my parents did it because something happened, you know? How is it even possible that one can, you know, through forgiveness and holiness and reading books and met Robin Sharma this week, you know. So through all of these things, what are we trying to achieve in that moment where it feels like your entire world is crumbling because I'm standing in the way of my parenting? I mean, does it mean that I need to go on some self-search journey? Is it a feeling that I'm looking for? Is something wrong with us? You know, should we divorce?
Yeah. So, again, I suppose it, like, the degrees matter. You know, if somebody is really struggling and you're thinking about divorce, then something has reached such a pitch, actually, that you do actually need help with it. Because, you know, when is it that you're wanting to divorce from your partner because they're not right for you? And when is it that you're divorcing from them because they evoke a feeling in you that you can't manage and you hope that the divorce is going to solve that and take it away? That's not going to solve the feeling. I don't know if feelings are there to be solved. They're there to communicate a need, you know? So I think what's so tricky is like knowing when to like do something more extreme, when to go for help, when to do something out there in the world, when to do something practical. I think it's probably a really good idea to just start to notice your feelings. I mean, I think that's something that every parent can do. Just like, geez, I'm feeling so terrible. I'm feeling so overwhelmed. I'm feeling so resentful.
I'm feeling irritated.
Yeah, especially those more horrible feelings, you know, the less unpalatable feelings. You know, that's often like, you know, that sort of fights with that blissful dream that we all had about being parents. You know, I think it's really hard to feel rage and really hard to feel resentment and jealousy. And, you know, those are the much stickier, you know, they're like molasses, those feelings, you know.
There's also an interesting feeling that I've noticed recently, and I couldn't pinpoint it until more recently. There's an unnatural joy that overcomes me when I plan we're either going to go camping or there's a trip for the family. So even if it's like a day trip or a picnic, there's something that happens to me when I go, okay, so we're going to go out for the day and packing the picnic basket. And then I call the kids to come and see what I'm packing.
Yeah.
And you know what? No one's going to eat half the food that's in it.
Yeah.
Or maybe everyone's going to get to the venue and we'll cry because it was too far. But there's this unnatural joy that overcomes me when I know that, okay, it's December. We're going to see the family in Cape Town. And I make it a lot of fun for the kids, you know, because that was a positive feeling that I had as a child. The road trip. Or the, you know, driving. I remember growing up, we had, and I'm sharing, I remember we have family in the Northern Cape in Dar. So I remember that was probably one of our happiest times growing up, you know, packing the car because we're going to drive to the Northern Cape. And then when you get there, there's nothing really to do for children, but the road trip was the fun, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So for you, it feels like it was a fun thing to all be on the same page in a way.
Mm.
Like, were you all like excited about the same thing? Everybody's experiencing the same feeling. There's something really nice about being on the same page as the person that you love. Actually, it's really hard when everyone feels something different, you know? I mean, the other in my book, which we'll talk about later, but it's reminded me of something that one of the analysts wrote about. She talked about, she says this example about, have you noticed how parents often conversation when the adults are just together, the conversation often drifts to going on holiday.
Hmm.
And her thing, which sounds like different to what you're talking about, but her thing was that it's because there's a need to escape. And that being a parent is so hard that often thinking about the holiday is a way to find a way to get out of the feeling you're in that moment and think about when you've overcome it and you're all together, maybe in that nice feeling again, you know? So when is being away, you know, something really fun to do, and when is the planning is really important, because it's like something about sort of being anywhere but where I am now, which is sometimes can just feel excruciating and or tiring or just enough, you know, and you need to just think about not being there for a minute, you know, which is everyone's prerogative, right? You have to find ways to cope.
I'm stuck on the clean slate that we spoke about earlier. You know, in a new year, I almost want to give everyone an imaginary clean slate and say, hey, we can do it again. It's 2025. Let's start over.
Yeah.
But the same gym habits and laziness.
Yeah.
And you still don't fit in your clothes.
Like, you're still actually the same person you were the week before. It's so weird.
And my kids still don't say thank you.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's like everything has followed you from the previous year into the new year.
Yeah.
And so how can one, and I don't want to use the word remedy, because we're not fixing, we are noticing.
Yes.
How do we pay attention to that? I mean, what advice can we help our parents with?
Yeah. New Year's resolutions. I've been thinking about this actually, because New Year's resolutions sort of make the clean slate very desirable. Like, it's like, I don't know. And we all do that. We all like put the new gym contract in place and the new diet and the, you know, I'm not going to get so angry with my mother-in-law or whatever, whatever it is, you know. But the thing is, like, there's a bit of a problem with wanting a clean slate, just as an idea. You know, people often come to me and they say, like, there's this thing, you know, they'll come for therapy and they'll say, there's this thing that I do. I need to stop doing that. And for months, they'll get cross with me because they're still doing the thing. Why haven't you taken it away?
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying very hard to take this thing. I want to clean the slate. And actually, I've got no interest in taking it away. I want to know why it's there.
Right.
If you try and clean the slate, it's undermining the slate. There's a whole story to why that thing arrived. So I want to know why. If you can understand why that thing is there that you're doing, it will eventually stop pressing to be heard in such a loud voice, and then maybe you can have some control over it. But I'm not in the business of wiping slates. I think it's very unfair to someone to try to do that. In spite of what any conscious thing will be, you know, like, I keep putting on weight or I keep doing this. Okay, you know, maybe you do have to think about those sort of things, but there's a meaning, and we have to understand why that compulsion's there. Why do you keep finding yourself in this pattern? I don't like to wipe it clean. I think I just want to know why are you finding it so hard to do? So that's the kind of the sort of angle that I look at things in.
Mm-hmm. And you could have found any title for her book, including Why Am I Standing in the Way of My Parenting, but she called it something else. So what did you call it?
So my book is called Parenting Psychoanalyzed, Letters to a Parent. And essentially what it is it's I approached 39 psychoanalysts from around the world, and I asked them to write a letter to parents out there about the thing that they struggled with as a parent themselves, and then to describe that dilemma through a psychoanalytic lens. And it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. We've got 39 letters that are sort of jargon-free, easy to read, you know, 6-7 page reads at the most. And it's just talking about the struggle that we all know and, you know, this love-hate relationship with it.
What is interesting is because what I haven't told you is that I have access to Andy's laptop. Actually, she sent it to me. So I got to read about 6 of the letters.
Yeah.
There was one that stood out for me. And if you don't mind, sure, can I bring it to the table?
Yeah.
So the one letter, it goes something like this. So the psychoanalyst is the father and he had a wife, the mother, and she then had a baby. And in the letter, he describes how his wife had just gone through hours of labor. And when this baby arrived, even though he has all the tools in the world and has read all the books in the world, the baby arrives and he has this unnatural, almost distance for this baby, because how could you have put my wife through all these hours of labor? You know, I've just seen what you've put my wife through. It made me scared. It made me so angry. And now you arrive, you know, little baby. That gave me the chills. It also gave me perspective that, you know, I often, even though this is support for parents and parents-to-be, I do have the mother in mind when I do some of the content, you know, because I feel for the mother, because I think the dad did not carry the baby. You know, even our dads and dads, I see you. I normally think you did not push this baby, you know?
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about that story?
You know, I think what's so lovely about the dads that have talked is that they've had this sort of like different, they like kind of bring a different perspective in, and they see things as an outsider, but they know less evoked, you know? And I think what I love about it is because I think the dads have a distance that we don't have as mothers. And they bring something that's a bit more like what we would call it, like paternal, like something a little bit more hard, like a bit of a harder edge, a little bit, because they're not like that, like soft and cuddly, you know, usually. I mean, I think I might be
generalizing.
Thank you. But I think like in stories like that, there's something about how the father brings in a different layering that actually there's something paternal in a mother as well that we have to find. You also have to put a hard line up. You also have to feel the hard things and be okay to act on them. You can't always be muddly and cuddly, you know? So for me, that's the kind of thing that that really sort of resonates with me about the dad speaking. You know, you never hear from the dads. So there are quite a lot. I would actually say that there's probably 50% of the stories in the book are fathers. There were a lot of dads that wanted to write, a lot of male psychoanalysts, and some world-renowned psychoanalysts. I couldn't believe the analysts who agreed to write. Like really, there's one analyst, I think he's now like 92, and he wrote about the pain of what it feels like to be leaving the world soon and what he wants to leave his children with, you know? So it really, there's a kind of frankness to the dads, which I really appreciate.
As a psychoanalyst, I want to present a few quick fires to you. So can psychotherapy, can it help me to be a good enough mother?
Ah, good enough. I think it's a really, can I unpack that for a minute? Because good enough is a complicated idea. I think that's sort of where you were starting as well. Like we're kind of wanting to be perfect. And I don't think we're doing ourselves any favors. That's the honest truth. I think there is this kind of, something's changed in the world where it's like, you have to be perfect. You have to be like this sort of, I don't know, gifted human who shows up 100%, who looks perfect, who never makes a mistake. Firstly, that's unattainable. But I don't actually know if it's helpful to a growing mind in the world. So, you know, I actually once put the question out to Facebook. I was writing an article and I wanted to just write on something that mothers want to do, hear about. So I went onto like my local community group and I said, as a mom, what do you struggle with? And I promise you, there were hundreds of comments saying, am I doing a good enough job? Am I a good enough mother? Am I this good enough, good enough, good enough? It was like it bombarded me. Now, there's a psychoanalyst called Donald Winnicott, who's not alive anymore, but he was also a pediatrician, and he coined this term, a good enough mother. What he discovered was that as mothers, you think that the way that you serve your child is by being perfect and giving them a seamless experience. Mm. Now, while that might be truer for the early baby, where you don't want any kind of impingements on the environment. Right. They cry, you come. They wet, you change them. Mm. Okay, so there is a little bit of that in the beginning. It has to be sort of a bubble, like something womb-like. Right. But like in time, that's not possible. Even like, I'm not talking about extreme things about leaving a baby to cry forever. I'm not talking about that. But almost like, okay, like you have to warm the bottle and it takes a minute. You know, or you have to wake yourself up in the middle of the night and get there. There's going to be a delay. And that's the stuff we're beating ourselves up about, like that delay in gratification. The thing is, what you don't realize is that over time, that gap has a psychological purpose for a growing mind. You are actually preparing your baby for a world that doesn't revolve around them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and slowly, if that happens enough times, that's why the good enough is in there. If you're good enough, if your baby feels that like tension, but then you show up enough times, the baby starts to lay down, okay, this is really hard. I'm hating this. I'm not getting what I need. Oh, there's mom. Okay, it will be okay.
Mm.
So that experience being laid over and over again is a good enough experience. You just have to show up enough times in a good enough way for your baby to internalize that the world is actually a nice place, even if I have to wait for what I want. And as adults, you better believe that we have to have internalized something like that, because nobody is like beating down our door to like fulfill all our needs.
No.
And the problem is that like social media, for an example, like that thing is like working against that human desire to have have a perfect thing. You know, you just served up content like, and it's now streamlined. So it speaks directly to you and what you want to see. And like, even like online shopping, it's seamless. You know, you don't even have to wait. You know, maybe now you can get your stuff in 60 minutes, you know, like it's God forbid we actually wait for what we need. And it pulls on those early tensions of not wanting to wait for what we want and for what we need to survive, you know. So, like, I think as parents, it's really important to, like, give ourselves some grace that actually when you don't show up, when you're not perfect, when you can't give the right answer to soothe your five-year-old in that moment, it's not the end of the world. You're actually helping them in another way that's intangible at the moment. And I think it's essential, actually.
You just reminded me of something as well, and maybe this is for another podcast, who knows, but we had a conversation on Baby Brunch about why couples fight. And then we also had one about, and this has actually happened to me in my relationship. There was a time that my husband wouldn't want to differ with me in conversation in front of the children. And I say to him, it's healthy sometimes that we disagree. It's not like we're loud or fighting, but, you know, it is okay for them to learn that we don't often agree on things. Like, surely they're learning. Well, I would rather have my children learn that at home than on the playground.
Yeah.
We don't all agree the whole time.
Well, I mean, I think, like there's something about diversity in that. Like, people are different and they're allowed to think different things, and that they love each other even if they don't agree. We need a bit of that in the world at the moment. We might have different ideas, but actually we can still love each other and get along. Like, you know, I think there's something really important about that. That's slightly different to a child feeling like they can strong on one parent over the other.
No, that doesn't happen. You try that in my house, or four children of mine. That's a complete, no, that's different.
You know, so there's you know, so, but disagreements in an ordinary way, I got no problem with that. I think it's really good. Yeah.
Andy Cohen, my favorite psychoanalyst, with the book and the stories, and I'm extremely excited to read all the other stories in the book, because the few that I've read has helped me not to judge myself so hard, you know? I'm a working mom, so when I do show up, there is this desire to do it perfectly all the time, you know.
Yeah.
But why should we stay curious? You know, in this world of being a parent and wanting to improve and wanting to live a good life, you know, why is curiosity good?
I feel like there's nothing better than having like something meaningful in your life. I think it's a little bit hard to only think that you're here to like do practical things and like achieve things in like a robotic way. I feel like we are very interesting, you know, and I feel like being a mother is actually this very unique opportunity to get to know yourself. So if your kid is like rubbing you up the wrong way, how do you find a position where you can get curiosity about the conflict? Because there are universes in you around that particular angst, you know? And so it's a really hard thing because I think being curious is like I think people can worry that it's like a bit of a Pandora's box because you can't find the gems without finding the pain. And I think there's a lot of conflict inside around getting to know yourself and surviving that. But I think it can go a long way for you and for your kids if you're kind of brave enough to do that.
In Annie's book, she also talks about how every child that is born is like a rebirth of the parents every single time. And depending on how many times you've gone through it, even you, mom of the unborn baby, you've had a rebirth every single time. Andy Cohen, it has been great to have you here. You are a gift to the world. Thank you for sharing your talent with us. May you psychoanalyze just write more books. We'll read it.
Deal. Thank you.
Find out more stories of Andy on Mind at Work, actually, a podcast. We'll share it for you on our platform as well. It's called Mind at, with an at sign, work. Otherwise, visit babybrunch.co.za.
This podcast was supported by Epimax Baby and Junior. Epimax Baby and Junior is dermatologist approved, free of artificial colorants and fragrances, and is safe to use from birth. Touch, nourish, love your child's skin with Epimax Baby and Junior. Available from leading pharmacies and retail stores.